My name is Edgar Mannheimer, and this is Kalam, a podcast about the Middle East.
And another day, I received two bullets in my thigh, and that was terrifying, two rubber bullets in my thigh. It's very painful, of course, and I was lucky that they didn't break my bone, because they could break your bones.
This is Islah Jad, a Palestinian feminist and academic who played a crucial role in the First Intifada. We'll be getting back to her in just a minute. But first, we'd like to encourage you to listen to the previous episodes of the Kalam podcast, since the first series on Palestine is somewhat chronological. So far, we've looked at the Nakba of 1948 from both a Palestinian and Israeli perspective, as well as the Six-Day War in 1967. In the first two episodes, I also give an introduction of myself. I'll summarize it by saying that my name is Edgar Mannheimer. I'm a Swedish radio journalist with Jewish ancestry who grew up in Egypt and Jordan and speaks Arabic. Today, we're looking at the First Intifada, the Palestinian uprising in the late 80s and early 90s, which shook Israel and the world. Largely non-violent, it tells a familiar story of Palestinian resistance and resilience coming out of setbacks and hardship. Here, I'm specifically talking about the bloody Lebanese Civil War, which ended in the PLO being kicked out of the country. But before we get into all of that, I'd just like to remind you that if you like the show, please subscribe and give us a rating. It helps other people find out about us. And if you want access to full-length interviews with all our guests, poetry and reading lists, and bonus episodes and content, or if you just want to support us, consider joining our Patreon community at patreon.com/kalampodcast for just $3 a month. Now, enough advertising, on to the show.
من قوة زنزانتي الصغرى أبصر أشجارا تبسم لي وسطوحا يملأها أهلي ونوافذ تبكي وتصلي من أجلي. من قوة زنزانتي الصغرى أبصر زنزانتك الكبرى.
From the narrow window of my small cell, I see trees that are smiling at me, and rooftops crowded with my family, and windows weeping and praying for me. From the narrow window of my small cell, I can see your big cell. Samih Qasim, who died in 2014 at the age of 75, was a Palestinian poet who served time in an Israeli prison for his political beliefs. His spirit was crushed by the defeat in 1967, which we spoke about last episode. But out of this soul-crushing experience, new resistance was born. In the stanza we just quoted, he reflects on the physical cell he is confined to, while his jailer is confined to a spiritual cell, Israel and Israelis being imprisoned by their oppression of the Palestinians. In this episode, we're going to look at the First Intifada. But to do that, we have to first examine the political landscape in the Middle East at the time. After the defeat in 1967, the Palestinian Liberation Organization, the PLO, moved its base of operations to Jordan, where it launched attacks against Israel. In 1970, the Jordanian king became fed up with the PLO and kicked them out, after fierce battles. This is when the PLO moved to Beirut, the capital city of Lebanon, located between the Mediterranean coast and lush green mountains, inhabited by a population known for its love of culture and art. Beirut is one of the most beautiful and rich cities in the world. Many Europeans moved to the city in the 60s and 70s to escape bad weather, lousy nightlife, and inflation. Little did they know, though, the Lebanese would soon be embroiled in one of the most brutal civil wars in modern history, some of the events of which trump any of the horrific scenes in Game of Thrones.
This was once the richest part of the richest city in the Middle East. Now it's the front line of the war in the Lebanon. Buildings where last year the money makers of the Western world exchanged their millions are now the barricades of Beirut. The war has lasted 12 months. It has ruined a country and destroyed a nation.
For most of the 20th century, Lebanon had been dominated by Maronite Christians, who made up a slight majority of the country, and who had been supported for decades by the French during its colonial mandate. But Lebanon was a diverse country, with many different Christian denominations, as well as large populations of Sunni and Shia Muslims, and a significant Druze population, the Druze being a kind of offshoot of Shia Islam, definitely worthy of a future episode or series on the Kalam podcast. In the early 1970s, when thousands of armed Palestinians came to Lebanon, the conservative Christian majority strongly disapproved. Not only did they believe that the majority Muslim Palestinians would shift the demographics of the country, but their influx increased the political tensions already existing in Lebanon. This was at the height of the Cold War, and the Christian elites in Lebanon largely supported the West and capitalism, while many Muslims and Druze supported pan-Arab left-wing policies. I say this, but this is of course an egregious generalization. The fact is that most of the founders of left-wing socialist and nationalist Arab political movements were themselves Christians, and many Muslims supported the capitalist West. Anyhow, for years, the PLO and other left-wing militias in Lebanon fought bitter battles against the mainly Christian conservatives and ultra-nationalists. It crippled the economy, split Beirut in two, and left the country in ruins. While all this was going on, however, the PLO kept launching strikes against Israel. This led to Israel launching the decisive 1982 invasion of southern Lebanon and implementing the siege of Beirut. During this invasion, the Israeli army coordinated with its ultranational Lebanese allies and watched while they massacred innocent Palestinian men, women, and children in the refugee camps of Sabra and Shatila, just south of Beirut, one of the most gruesome events of the war.
The ruins of a Palestinian refugee camp on the outskirts of Beirut. Shattered buildings, broken bodies. This is the horrific aftermath of the Beirut massacre, when several hundred defenseless Palestinians were brutally murdered.
This massacre took place just after the PLO were forced out of Lebanon, despite various Western guarantees. The defeated PLO leadership relocated to Tunisia, far away from the realities of Palestine. This was seen as a major setback and was extremely demoralizing for the Palestinian movement. But it was out of this sense of defeat that the seeds of the First Intifada were sown. In Palestine in the late 1980s, the Israeli occupation was nearing its 20th birthday and getting comfortable. But seemingly out of nowhere, a mass movement of protests, strikes, and boycotts inside the occupied West Bank and Gaza brought Israel to its knees and forced it, for the first time in its history, to negotiate with the Palestinians. The movement became known as the First Intifada and was largely led by women. Images of women and children being brutalized by heavily armed Israeli soldiers simply for throwing stones shook the world.
It's been going on every day for 7 days, and there's no sign that it's going away.
Life under Israeli occupation became too intolerable for the Palestinians to take.
The land where they live has been under the control of Israel for 20 years.
Islah Jad has for decades been a prominent member of the Palestinian women's movement and is an associate professor of political science at the Department of Women's Studies at Bir Zeit University in Palestine. Her book, Palestinian Women's Activism, Nationalism, Secularism, and Islamism, traces the role of women in the Palestinian liberation struggle for the past 100 years. We begin our conversation with recounting the large amount of work that preceded the immediate trigger of the uprising, the killing of four Palestinian laborers in Gaza when their car collided with an Israeli truck. Now, without further ado, here is Islah Jad.
That was the trigger, but before the trigger, there was lots of work to prepare this, you know, moment to endure, to be sustained, you know. For example, when it comes to the women's movement, women, you know, of course, they were active in their political parties, but the political parties were banned, and they were working secretly underground. So there was this great invention that, you know, led some activists to form what became known as grassroots organizations.
By the late 1980s, Israel had banned most Palestinian political parties active in the West Bank and Gaza, and had jailed and exiled many of its leaders. But as Islah Jad says here, women were organized into what were called direct action committees that had plausible deniability when it came to accusations of party membership. This proved to be hugely successful.
It's open kind of organizations to host many, many women. And you don't need to be a member in the political party to be part of these organizations. And these organizations were basically doing different activities seen from outside as charitable work. Like, you know, running kindergartens, like, you know, running cooperatives, food processing for local consumption, activities usually done by charitable organizations. But the difference is that, these activities were used as a tool to mobilize and organize women. So that's why we saw in the first uprising these huge masses of women in the streets, because they were in a way connected to these kind of organizations, and these kind of organizations shouldered actually the endurance and the sustainability of the first Palestinian uprising when it comes to women.
Yeah. If we could back up a little bit and talk about the historical setting of where we are right now in the struggle for the liberation of Palestine. The first Intifada takes place in the late 80s, but before then, the Palestinian Liberation Movement has been embroiled in a really bloody and tragic civil war in Lebanon, and the Israelis ended up invading southern Lebanon in 1982, and the Palestinian official movement leadership had to move to Tunisia. So could you give us a kind of idea of where we are when this happens politically?
Well, you know, the deportation or the kicking out of the PLO and all political organizations belonging to the PLO out of Lebanon was a bit demoralizing for the people. It took place in 1982, and we are talking about the first uprising that took place in the late 87. You know, and after Beirut, of course, there was the Arab summit that did not mention anything about the question of Palestine, as if, you know, the question was closed and the PLO, you know, refugees in a faraway country like Tunisia that hosted them warmly. But Tunisia is not Lebanon, and it is not Jordan, and it's not Egypt. Starting from 82, I could say that the political weight, you know, moved into the occupied territories, that if we are waiting for Godot for outside to come and save the Palestinian people, this will not happen. And people has to find ways to defend themselves and to continue the struggle for their cause, you know. And at that time, you know, when we talk about late 70s, early 80s, all the grassroots organizations I mentioned were formed during this time. In the meanwhile, inside what we call the Green Line, I mean, among Palestinians in Israel, also it was the Land Day.
The 30th of March every year marks Land Day, Yom al-Ard, uniting Palestinian citizens of Israel and those within the 1967 borders. A day of resistance and sumud, standing one's ground, standing firm on one's land. It was in 1976 that protests erupted against the Israeli state as it confiscated Arab-owned land in the Negev and Galilee. 10 people were killed by Israeli forces and hundreds were injured. Since then, March 30th is commemorated annually by Palestinians, a rallying call for the right to remain on one's land in the face of settler colonialism. Check out our Instagram at Kalam Podcast to see a collection of Palestinian political posters commemorating Land Day throughout the years.
That was also another, you know, flame that was feeding the people resistance against the Israelis.
I'd like to touch on something that you also mentioned, which was the importance of Palestinians inside Palestine, both in the green historic Palestine and in the occupied territories, that they themselves, and I guess you yourself, because you were very much a part of it personally, took up the banner of the liberation movement and sort of from the grassroots level created this intifada, this uprising, without any directives from, at this point, Tunisia, which is where Yasser Arafat and the PLO were. What is the significance of that?
That was very important in the sense that it was an opportunity to form local leaders in the occupied territories from the people themselves, knowing their situation, knowing their circumstances, not far away as the leadership, you know, in Tunisia at that time. Of course, you know, all political parties active in the occupied territories at that time were members of the PLO. But as I said, the parties were members. But what we are putting the focus on here is the grassroots movement. Each political party managed to create its union activism branch, women branch, student branch, teachers branch, etc. So these kind of organizations that are not party members themselves, but linked to the political parties, was a very important move to enlarge the constituencies of these political parties and also to have the ability to form new leaders, new popular leaders, because, you know, as in all the Arab country, you know, when you have a leader of a political organization, the same leader stays in his place till his death, you know. But with these kind of organizations, no, a new blood was emerging and creative and coming with new ideas and the ability to decide on what programs, what language is suitable to organize and mobilize the people. So that was very, very important step away from the PLO historical leadership. And these are the leaders that shouldered all the activities during the first uprising, you know. I mean, among women, among students, you have so many names that became known out of their leading role in this, you know, mass demonstrations and mass movement that emerged in the first Palestinian uprising.
Were you yourself a member of any committee? And if so, what was your role personally? How did you contribute to the movement?
Because, you know, the grassroots organizations were divided along the lines of political parties. And I was not aligned to any political party, but I was rather leaning to the left side of, you know, of parties. So I was not a member per se, but I was an active street member. I mean, I joined all the activities and I disseminated the activities programs to other friends. And I remember many other people was asking me when you have, you know, an idea about when to meet or the coming activities, please let us know. And I, you know, I used to spread the word through friends and colleagues in the university. Among them, it was Hanana Ashrawi. She even mentioned that in her book, that I was always telling them when the coming activity will take place, etc. So from within this activity, a new need emerged because, you know, the pictures on the screens was so overwhelming, you know. You see tens of thousands of women fighting with their bare hands, the armed to teeth Israeli soldiers.
This was a crucial aspect of the First Intifada. For the first time, the Palestinian cause gained widespread sympathy in the Western world, largely through newsreels like this one.
Saturday morning in the Gaza Strip, and the Israeli army had just arrested a suspect. The Palestinian spotted a television camera and in Hebrew started protesting his innocence. Under the controversial policy of subduing protesters, Israeli soldiers can use force against those who resist. In this case, the suspect was taken almost but not quite out of camera range. Dragged back outside, his face told the story of his punishment. The kind of beating the Israeli army said yesterday will be administered only in extreme cases.
So a new role emerged, was basically to speak about what is taking place and to explain why this happened, because the image Israel managed always to draw for itself is the oasis of democracy. It's the most ethical army in the Middle East. It's oasis, you know, against barbarism and despotism and all the rest that you know. So the pictures were very strong. I mean, how come you can see a soldier armed to his teeth, you know, running after a child or a young boy or a girl or a woman, civilian people, you know, and breaking their bones, kicking their heads against the wall, killing, you know, injuring. It was so shocking, you know, to see this contrast between some civilians rejecting the oppression of the Israeli occupation and an army that is armed to its teeth, you know, suppressing these civilians by all brutal and inhumane way. So the role that emerged is to speak about that, to explain why it's happening and what is the true nature of the Israeli occupation. And this is when we started to get involved. I mean, the people, we began to be part of many speaking tours in Western world or Asia or in Latin America to speak about the Intifada.
Yeah, certainly I think the images that we saw, that the world saw on news bulletins and in documentaries and on TV from the First Intifada was, I think, the first time for many people, especially in the West, like you said, that had this idea of Israel as, you know, a David and the wicked Arabs as Goliath or something, that the first time that they see these soldiers armed to the teeth, not just fighting against other soldiers, but fighting civilians and fighting children, throwing rocks and even fighting women. And the response that the Israelis took to this grassroots movement was very, very tough and very severe. How did you experience this? Were you ever treated in such a violent, rough way by, when you were taking part in demonstrations, for example?
Of course, I remember a situation where I was kicked by a machine gun by a soldier. You know, he was holding his machine gun and pushing my chest and neck, you know, with his machine gun. So we were struggling. I was trying to keep him away, and he was pushing, you know, hard. So I don't know why. He was rather a small-sized soldier, and I was a bit taller than him. So suddenly, I found his machine gun in my hand. And this is a moment I was terrified, because the first thing they will do is shooting. They will shoot at me because, you know, they will think that I took his machine gun to kill him. So this is when I pushed him and he fell on the ground, and I left his machine gun on him. I threw it on him and I had to run away. They ran after me, but I managed to hide that day. And another day, I received two bullets in my thigh, and that was terrifying, two rubber bullets in my thigh. It's very painful, of course, and I was lucky that they didn't break my bone, because they could break your bones. And I managed also to jump into a small veranda and hide. And I remember that day when I entered the house that I was hidden in, the inhabitants of the house were deaf. So they didn't understand what is going on around them. So I, it took me some time to realize that they cannot hear me when I talk, or they cannot talk. So I had to make lots of signs, you know, to explain to them what happened. And I had to show them the bullets I got in my thigh to know that I'm hiding. And I need them to help me in hiding. So these are the two moments I remember very well. But it was, of course, you know, very scary, because when the army attacks the demonstrators, they shoot. Sometimes you never know if it's real bullets or rubber bullets or what sort of bullets, because even the rubber bullets they used excessively at that time, if it penetrates your head or forehead, it could kill, you know, and many people were killed, of course, by the use of these bullets. Besides the huge amount they used to use of tear gas bombs, that was really a horrible thing also. Besides stun grenades, you know, it's deafening when it is thrown close to you.
Yeah. Why do you think it was that women took such a big role in the First Intifada?
Because, you know, first of all, women realized that their men cannot defend them, you know. I mean, the Israelis were always targeting, if they enter a house or they break into a house, the first thing they used to do is to bring the father or the family head or whatever and start beating him brutally in front of his family. And this is to show that your protector cannot protect himself. So that was the first message. And if, you know, the army come to arrest one of the children in a family, if especially the father interferes, it will be much worse, because he could be killed, he could be injured, he could be arrested himself. So the fathers were the least capable to defend their kids, you know, or their families. So here was the role of women, you know, and the role of women, that they were more daring. I don't want to say more courageous, but they were more daring, you know, in throwing their bodies on their children and or their husbands and trying to protect them. Of course, many women were killed also and injured, you know, in doing so. But the assumption is that we are women and we should not be treated as they treat, you know, men. So this, you know, feminine or motherhood, you know, factor was in the help of women to be more daring and more, you know, protective of their family members and their kids. And this is something the Israelis were aware of it. And that's why, you know, excessive targeting of women now in Gaza, even your role as a mother or a feminine nature would not be helpful in any way in protecting yourself or protecting your children or your family. And also the excessive threat of raping and raping in Israeli prisons, you know, that if you resist, you will shame your family and you will be ashamed yourself, which is, of course, in the Palestinian context, it was something, a practice by the Israelis that resulted in an opposite result. For example, in Iraq, sometimes women who were raped in American prisons, some cases they committed suicide, or a few cases were killed also by their families, because, you know, they have been seen as, you know, shaming the honor of their families. In the Palestinian context, it's the opposite. In 1968, a very courageous activist at that time from Nablus, Randa Nabulsi, She talked in details in the military court in Nablus about the kind of treatment she got in when she was in the prison. She talked about sexual harassment. She talked about so many shameful acts done by the Israeli interrogators at that time. So the political awareness that this is a sort of practice used against our women to shame the society and to break its will. So the political parties at that time, you know, played a major role in glorifying these women and instead of shaming them, no, it was a practice to honor them and to present them as national icons full of pride and strong will to resist their occupiers.
I know we've spoken for a long time. I don't want to take up too much more of your time. Thank you so much for participating. Another aspect of the Intifada was the boycotting of Israeli products, or if we could even speak about the economic resistance. And as far as I've understood, that was extremely effective because the Palestinian and Israeli economies were and are inseparable. I mean, they're completely intertwined because, you know, you live under occupation, you use the same currency, you buy products from each other, you sell to each other. So when Palestinian vendors went on strike and said, we're completely doing the boycott, this really hurt the Israeli economy and was even more of an incentive to the Israelis to crack down on this movement. So how significant was this boycott movement and how did it look like?
During the first uprising, women played a major role in what became known as home economy, cultivating your own garden. There were lots of organizations helping people to plant their own garden and to be, in a way, self-sufficient of what they need of vegetables or fruits or whatever. And women were very active in the call of boycotting Israeli products. Since as long as you have a Palestinian product, you should use it and do not use any similar Israeli product. Because, you know, Israel as an occupier and a settler colonial entity, part of its role was to erase your culture, to erase your identity, to erase even your history, of course. And one of the activities of erasure this way was the claim that the hummus, for example, is an Israeli made, that the falafel is an Israeli. So we saw in our markets lots of Israeli products that are originally Palestinians, that like labani, for example, like hummus, like falafel, like many other products that belong to the Palestinian culture. And of course, beside that, they were really disgusting in a way that they are not tasty at all. Yani. But of course, they were cheaper. They were cheap in the market. And the market was open for all their garbage. So the boycott was very effective that we will not use their so-called labani. We will not use their so-called hummus. So this is our product and we will kick out all Israeli products claiming that, you know, they are suiting our taste or whatever.
This boycott and strike movement was extremely effective during the first Intifada. The New York Times reported at the time that the Israeli Defense Ministry had lost $162 million and that the Israeli economy was in danger if the rebellion continued.
And home economy, women saw that this is very important role to play. I mean, instead of buying jam from the market, they used to make their own jam. And this is, you know, part of the Palestinian culture. And because people are witnessing instability of the political context and the continuous strikes and curfews, etc. So in any Palestinian house, you will see people storing, you know, flour for the whole year, for example, sugar, olive oil, olives, greens, for example, lentils or whatever, and they have the techniques and the know-how to store this kind of products for the whole year, like the white cheese, for example. So the revival of these cultural habits was so important to survive, because the question was to survive. You know that if all the bakeries are closed, you can bake your own bread. I remember, for example, when I finished my master's degree from France and I came back to the West Bank in Ramallah, the first thing I asked my mother-in-law to teach me is how to make a dough, how to bake. And she was laughing at me, oh, coming from Paris to learn how to bake. I said, of course, because, you know, I need to feed my kids. And if I don't know how to make the dough or bake my bread, my kids will starve, you know. So these are basic skills that you have to learn in order to survive.
Sure. So if we return to the political context in which kind of the first Intifada ended up creating, which is the conferences in Madrid and Washington. Many people may think that that kind of, well, Oslo is a bit different, and maybe we can get into that. But when it comes to the first sort of peace talks, serious peace talks in Madrid in 91 and Washington, I believe, in the same year or the year after, many of the people that represented the Palestinian delegation were the same grassroots leaders that had created and supported and popularized the First Intifada. A character, like you mentioned, Hanan Ashrawi, for example. How are they connected? They are obviously connected, but how did the First Intifada spark such an important international conference as the Madrid?
If you review the history of the Palestinian cause, it is always like this. After each revolt or, you know, revolution, you find, you know, Western countries coming to organize conference or send a delegation and form a commission to find a political solution. And of course, the political solution never, you know, lead to any tangible solution at the end. You know, it was just for Israel to absorb the anger and the resistance of the people and gain time to change things on the ground, to change reality on the ground. The first uprising showed that it is impossible to continue occupying Palestinians without any future solution. So this is when Madrid conference came, as you said, with trustworthy leadership. Dr. Haider Abdeshafi is very well respected Palestinian from Gaza, Hanan Ashrawi, Faisal Husseini, and many others.
Of the names mentioned here by Islah, Dr. Hanan Ashrawi is the only one still alive, and she to this day regularly appears on Western TV screens advocating for the Palestinian cause.
And of course, we know that Israel never accepted any international intervention for solving the Palestinian question, except the only resolution that Israel accepted all along was the partition plan in 1947. After this, Israel, you know, worked always to change reality on the ground, which is gaining and confiscating and controlling more land and doing everything possible to strangle the people and push them out of their land. You know, so the question was always having more land with less people. So the Madrid conference, you know, didn't lead to any, as I said, tangible solution. The Israeli prime minister at that time wrote in his memoir that his plan was to keep the negotiations going for 10 years till he controls more land. So there was never a will to share the land with the Palestinians. The Zionist goal all along was to control the land and kick the people out.
Yeah. Islah Jad, thank you so much for being a guest today. I'm going to let you go in just a second, but I thought if you want to give some conclusory thoughts on what do you think the First Intifada means today in light of what's happening in Gaza and what's happening with the Palestinian international campaign for liberation. What's the legacy of the First Intifada?
The first legacy is that the people discover their power. First of all, that you discover really that you have lots of power, you know, even if you are armless, if you don't have the most sophisticated arms, you know, as your enemy is having, but you have your own strong will and your resilience that you will never give up on your right. You will never give it up, because this land belonged to a people that lived on it for centuries, you know. So this is number one. Number two is that when you are always struggling to regain your right, you have a moral power that, you know, it helps you to pay a heavy sacrificing price. Because you have this moral power in you that keeps pushing you to claim your rights, even though with the most oppressive machine in front of you. So you this strong moral ground is very important, and it gives you lots of power and gives you lots of courage that you should never give up on your right, and we should never give up on our rights.
Thank you so much, Islah Jad, for being a guest on the Kalam podcast. It was a pleasure.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
That was the Palestinian feminist and associate professor at Bir Zeit University, Islah Jad. For more of her unique insights, check out her book, Palestinian Women's Activism, Nationalism, Secularism, and Islamism, that traces the role of women in the Palestinian liberation struggle for the past 100 years. Next week, we're going to look at the U.S.-brokered Israeli-Palestinian negotiations that came out of the First Intifada and ended in the Oslo Accords. The Oslo Accords, which according to many Palestinians, was the ultimate betrayal of the Palestinian cause. The collapse of the talks led to the much more violent and desperate Second Intifada and the rise of Hamas. With us next week to discuss all of this is the prominent Palestinian human rights defender, Sahar Francis. Until then, follow us on social media at Kalam Podcast and join our Patreon club for exclusive content at patreon.com/Kalam Podcast. Kalam was written and hosted by me, Edgar Mannheimer. Research and production by Sam Karl Samra. Poetry reading in Arabic by Khulud Saghir. And sound design by Arthur Mannheimer.